And welcome back. In the first segment, we talked about St. Louis police, and police would certainly be among the first responders here in the event of any major emergency, including a terrorist attack. Such an attack is not as far-fetched a possibility as some might think, especially if the United States retaliates for those deadly poison gas attacks in Syria last month. Critics of potential U.S. punitive action fear it could lead to terrorist action in this country. In studio to talk about all of this are Dr. Alexander Garza, Associate Dean for Public Health Practice and Associate Professor of Epidemiology at St. Louis University. He's also former Assistant Secretary of Health Affairs and Chief Medical Officer for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. He is considered an expert on weapons of mass destruction and health threats to national security. Nick Regnani is Executive Director of STARS, St. Louis Area Regional Response System. STARS coordinates regional response and planning for large-scale critical incidents. Gentlemen, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alex, welcome to St. Louis.
Thank you.
You're a brand new resident. Glad to have you here.
Well, I grew up in St. Louis, so this is a homecoming for me.
Oh, good. So, well, yeah. all the better then.
Thank you.
Let me start with you. What do you make of the gas attack in Syria?
Well, it's certainly a game changer. You know, if you look at the history of chemical attacks or the use of chemical weapons as a means of warfare, it's a very limited group of people that have used these, and they're usually not nice people to be around. And so this sort of fits along the same lineage as that. Chemical weapons, as I think most everybody understands, have been universally declared as not for use in warfare by most of the world except for a couple of countries, Syria being one of them, and for good reason. It's a horrific weapon. You know, it's inhumane. Its only use is to kill and to sow terror amongst the society. And so, the president, I think, is taking all the appropriate actions that he should be doing in saying that this is against societal norms. It's against the law of the international treaties and formulating the response from the U.S.
Is it overstating the case, do you think, to suggest that this could lead to a possible terrorist retaliation of some form?
Well, it's sort of an open-ended question. And so terrorism, of course, is always out there. And so you always have that underlying current of what we're susceptible to or what the threats are out there. But I think part of the president's message in developing a response to this is to show to the world that this is inappropriate behavior and this will not be tolerated at any level, whether it's state-sponsored or whether it's a terrorism event. Now, certainly, the weapon that was used in Syria was a state-sponsored weapon. It was a very intricate weapon. It was very refined. But that isn't to say that there are capabilities out there where people could develop something like this. And the obvious example is Amshin Rikyo from more than a couple of decades ago over in Japan, where it was a terrorist attack on the subway system. And that was, of course, they were educated people and they were well-funded. But again, they did show that it is possible to have a civilian equivalent of that chemical weapon.
It wouldn't necessarily have to be a chemical attack, though, if there were retaliation.
Sure. No, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Nick, how about you? What are your thoughts about this? And what is STARS doing as all of this is going on?
Well, obviously, this is something we've been planning for a very long time. We've started this type of planning back in 2003 and continue it even today and know that those threats still exist as they did back in 2003, which at that time the height of awareness was drawn to us because of the 9/11 attacks and also the anthrax scare that occurred shortly after that. It showed us that there is a possibility that we could be vulnerable for the use of a WMD, a weapon of mass destruction, or a chemical use of a dispersant somewhere in the St. Louis area that we would have to respond to. So it's still there. It's something we know it existed, and we're still planning for it.
But we're here in the middle of the country. You would think that we would be safe and secure, that it would be difficult for anything to happen here. Your thoughts about that?
Well, that's kind of what they thought in Oklahoma City also. We are the soft target. Terrorists look for the point of least resistance, and that's where they're wherever they can find the easy path to bring forth their destruction, they're going to do that. And that's why we have to always stay vigilant.
What kinds of things are we doing? Now, I know you don't want to tell the bad guys what we're doing, but give us some sense of what we do.
One of the big things over the last several years we've done is prepared the first responders on how to respond to these type of incidents, whether it's a bombing like what occurred at the Boston Marathon or something more sophisticated like what happened with the Amshin Rikyo in March of 1995 when they released a crude form of sarin gas, if even was gas, I think it was a liquid form, back on the Tokyo subway. And when that happened, that kind of wakened up the first responder community as well as public health and hospitals to realize this could occur, and we've got to get trained on how we can deal with those type of incidents. So ever since then, not only have we bought equipment on how to respond to it, but we've provided the training on how to do it, as well as doing several exercises here in the St. Louis area to test that capability to be able to not only respond to the victims at the scene of the incident, but then transport them to the hospitals and care for them in the emergency rooms as well, which is the biggest threat in a chemical type release like that.
Alice, I guess this brings us to your area of expertise. So you started out as an EMT.
I did. Here in St. Louis.
Here in St. Louis. Yeah. So in terms of your time with Homeland Security, mm-hmm. what do you think is going on there now with regard to all of this?
Sure. So I'm quite certain that the Department of Homeland Security is taking a look at all of the precautions and the planning that they've done throughout the years and saying, how can we improve it? How can we make it better? Where do we think there are our capability gaps are? And making sure that that they can assist, the state and locals if there was an incident to occur, because primarily, especially with a chemical event, it's a very sudden event. So and usually, the first indication that something is wrong is somebody is sick or somebody's dying. It's very different from other types of WMD threats. With a bacterial threat, it usually takes a little while for incubation for people to get sick. But with chemical event, it's very sudden. And it's those few minutes after the incident happens that's going to really make a determination on life and death, quite literally.
Should communities, states, whatever, have antidotes of some sort available to deal with
sure.
The various things that could happen?
Right, and they do. And so there's a program in place that the CDC CDC heads called ChemPAC, and I'm pretty sure that St.
Sure
Louis
enough.
Is part
yeah.
of this program.
Yes.
And for those reasons, you want to push the antidotes as far forward as you can, give them to the first responders because those are the ones that are going to be taking care of these victims. It's not going to be the federal government swooping in to save the day. It's going to be the first responders, the local people taking care of these folks.
Nick, what is a STARS association with Homeland Security? There is a connect there, is there not?
They're our funding source. That's where we receive the grants so that we can prepare the region for these type of incidents. They also provide us with guidance on what we should be preparing for and the method, the plan should be developed, and also provide a lot of training and overall guidance for these type of situations.
What kind of training? How training and how extensive is it for our first responders, our police and fire departments?
It could be as simple as everyone meets at the firehouse and we give them some type of training on how to use a piece of instrument, a meter that would detect a chemical gas or a sarin if that would be the case. Or it could be more sophisticated where they're sent somewhere here in the country where they can actually train on those particular chemicals so they learn how to deal with those type of situations.
I mentioned we're secure here in the middle of the country, but we do have what could be considered prime targets for someone who wants to do us harm.
Sure. Just if you stop and think of what the historical significance is of the St. Louis area, where the largest population centers would be, are some of our key transportation points of entry. Those are all the type of places that they would be looking for. The big thing is always look for a large population because that gives them that impact that they're looking for.
Well, that's something that I don't know if we should be talking about it or not. We should certainly be aware of the potential for things going on, but we don't want to frighten people. Alex, that's something we must guard against as well.
Right. And so these are low probability events. But what makes them different is they're not completely absent from our risk territory. It's still out there. And the issue is that it carries a lot of high consequence. So if the event were to occur, you can have a lot of people sick, ill, and injured. And that's what makes them so problematic. This was a big issue that we tried to tackle every day at the federal level. How can we combat these one-off events that don't happen every day? But if they do happen, they're going to have terrible consequences to them. You think back to 9/11, nobody would have ever suspected the day before 9/11 that a plane would be used as really a missile into a heavily populated area. Nobody would have thought that. And so our job really is to think of those events, and how can we develop some form of protection for the American public so that if these events were to occur, that we have a relatively good chance of surviving them and doing well afterwards.
Nick, how well plugged in are we here to national security issues? I understand the connection with Homeland Security, but how do we learn if there is some suspicion that something could happen here?
Well, for one thing, the St. Louis City Police Department and the St. Louis County Police Department both operate what's called a Terrorism Early Warning Unit, which is the police intelligence units that get those early indications of what's going on across the country. Something unique may happen that then sets off the alert, and they will communicate across various different lines, whether by phone call, by email, or at least be able to share information about something that may have been discovered that could lead to something larger. A good example would be like the 9/11 attacks. There were various flags that went up prior to that 9/11 attack where things like people were trying to learn how to fly an airplane. They didn't want to learn how to take off or land. They just wanted to learn how to fly it from one point to another. Now, that seems to be unusual. Well, since it was unusual, nobody really keyed on it until after the fact, and then they saw what they were really trying to do. So if you get that occurring at several different places around the country and law enforcement agencies are sharing that information, you can get that early warning to know what to expect and what they're going to do. A good example of that was the a shoe bomber. When that happened, now all of a sudden we all have to take our shoes off at the airport and be checked as you go before you take an airline somewhere.
Yeah, we also should point out that there was the underwear bomber and exactly. That the target for him apparently was Detroit. So it doesn't necessarily have to be on either of the coasts.
Right. And there's one other thing, Don, and I believe this is true for St. Louis as well, is the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is usually headed up by the FBI. And the FBI has a WMD coordinator in every one of their field offices who specializes in things like chemical attacks and biological attacks. And so they're also a huge asset to help coordinate with state, local, as well as the federal government.
With regard to other issues that could involve emergency in this area, Nick, you know, we've got a lot of bridges. We talk about earthquakes. We can talk about any number of disasters that could happen here.
Exactly.
This is something that STARS probably spends a lot more time dealing with.
Well, it's equal share time. Let's put it that way, because all of those, as we were talking before about the potential of a terrorist attack, it's different, but it's pretty much on the same scale of preparing for an earthquake or preparing for a tornado, or in some states even preparing for flooding. It's something that we need to be prepared for, so we run those different scenarios and make sure we have the equipment and the training in place to be able to take care of them. But it's just something that's unique to this area that we all accept and we go about our daily lives. But in the background, we kind of know that there may be an earthquake or there may be a tornado someday here in the St. Louis area.
Just as kind of an aside here, our first segment of the program today dealt with local control now, the St. Louis Police Department. From your point of view, is this going to make this an easier area to police and deal with issues of the kind we're talking about now?
It'll make it easier within the city government so they can coordinate what the response would be within City Hall towards the police department. But as far as the region goes, it was still the same. It will still be the same.
Alex, one of the things I know that you were dealing with in your previous life was the potential for pandemic, for instance.
Right.
Give us some sense of what that was all, because that's not unlike what we're talking about.
It's just it's
different
it's,
delivery system.
Right, exactly. It's just a different agent is really what it is. And it's interesting that you bring that up. We were discussing this in the waiting room outside of things that keep us up at night. And I was explaining how I thought pandemic or emerging infectious disease was really one of the more scary thing, if not the most scary thing. And the reason why I say that is because emerging infectious disease really plays no favorites. And so usually with a terrorist attack, it's one or two, maybe three sites that get hit. The event happens. It's over. We can respond to it. We can take care of the people that were affected. But if H1N1 taught us anything, this is going to be a widespread global problem. There's not going to be a discrete beginning and an end. It's going to be an ongoing event that we're going to have to deal with. And it's going to spread throughout multiple segments of society, not just the people that are sick, but the healthcare industry, the business industry. If you can't show up for work, business can't go on. Many different parts of society are going to be impacted when it comes to a pandemic. And so we're relatively fortunate with H1N1 that it wasn't worse than what it was.
Nick, what were you saying during this conversation with Alex in our green room?
It was exactly that. Of all the things that we prepare for, we know what the capabilities are for responding to an earthquake and to tornadoes and all the other natural and some technological disasters. But the one that really does concern us is the pandemic, because that's one that's going to sneak in at night. It's not going to be there for a while, or it'll be around, but we won't know it's there. And by the time it hits, we're already several days behind it, trying to catch it, find out what it is, where it came from, how it was introduced, whether it was in the air, in the water systems, in the food stream, or how exactly people are being infected, and then how to combat it, what type of drugs we need to take care of those who are victims.
How do you work with hospitals and the medical community here on an issue such as this one?
One of our greatest efforts has been working with the region's hospitals. There's like 50-plus hospitals here in the St. Louis area who meet regularly on the STARS committee to determine how we can respond to all these type of situations, whether it is a pandemic, a terrorist attack, or an earthquake. It's a really active committee that takes on these type of issues, and every year they do various types of exercises together. The unique thing before STARS was they all did their individual type of responses within their hospitals. But when STARS came along, we got them all working together as a total unit so they can share resources when a major event does occur.
Alex, I suppose, again, in your earlier work, that this is something you looked at on a national level.
Right. So the better that we can coordinate between each other, the better off that we're going to be. And so part of our mission at Homeland Security, as well as HHS and other federal organizations, was try to come up with global strategies that state and locals could adopt and use at the local level. And so anytime that we could get multiple different players from the community to come together to work on these problems, it was beneficial for everybody.
How does that work? Is it an easy process getting this kind of coordination?
Well, nothing is easy in the federal government, but getting the right people at the table was important. And so making sure that everybody's voice is heard, both at the federal level, but you have to have the state and local input. We just can't develop policy at the federal level, because as soon as we write something down on paper, somebody at the state and local is going to take a look at it and say, well, that will never work in our community because of X, Y, and Z. And so making sure that we had the right representation from the different parts of the community at the table as we were developing policy was very important.
I have to take a break now. We'll do that and come back. My guests in studio are Dr. Alexander Garza, Associate Dean for Public Health Practice at St. Louis University, former Assistant Secretary of Health Affairs and Chief Medical Officer for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Also in studio is Nick Grignani, Executive Director of STARS, the St. Louis Area Regional Response System. We're talking about emergency preparedness in our region, and actually the conversation was triggered by the potential, and we say there is some potential for a terrorist act of some sort in this country if the United States follows through with its punitive strike against Syria. That, of course, is still in the works. We're hearing about that every day. We'll come back and continue the conversation about emergency preparedness here and invite your questions. What are your concerns? How well protected do you think we are? Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, and we'll take a tweet at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello back. Hello, or welcome back, I should say. We're going to continue our conversation on emergency preparedness for our region. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri Attorney General Chris Koster has sent a letter to members of the General Assembly about House Bill 436. That's the anti-federal gun law bill, which Governor Nixon vetoed, saying it would have ended cooperative efforts between state and federal law enforcement agencies, giving criminals the right to sue police officers, and legally barred state troopers from notifying federal authorities if a gun dealer sells guns to illegal immigrants. Also, the St. Louis County Council meets this evening. These stories and more this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day on St. Louis STLPublicRadio.org. Back to our conversation in studio with Dr. Alexander Garza, Associate Dean for Public Health Practice at St. Louis University. He, by the way, is also former Assistant Secretary of Health Affairs and Chief Medical Officer for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Also with me is Nick Ragnani, Executive Director of STARS, the St. Louis Area Regional Response Team. You know, mentioning that we are accessible via Twitter brings to mind the use of social media, Alex, and the kind of work you do and have been doing. What sort of a role does it play?
So social media plays a huge role, actually, in both looking at disease from a different perspective or looking at threats from a different perspective, as well as tracking recovery. So FEMA made a large investment in developing social media for their response to different disasters. Part of the problem with any disaster is communication. And so being able to have people directly communicate with the disaster response centers, things like that, was a huge asset to FEMA. But as well in gathering information as well, and I don't want to, you know, there's a lot of news out there about NSA and things like that, but there is a fair amount of information about using things like Google Flu and tweets and things like that to track disease surveillance. And so there's some well-known articles out there about looking at the trends on Google and comparing that to the flu rate and showing a pretty good correlation. And so you could use the same thing with tweets. The issue that you get into is how valid is what you're seeing over the tweet. And so, for instance, if you're looking for just something with a hashtag fever, well, you know, we found out that that could mean beaver fever from Justin Bieber instead of fever from influenza. And so you have to be really careful about what you're looking at and make sure it correlates well.
It's the same thing in journalism. It's proved a valuable tool in many instances, but there's always that question mark as to how accurate or valid the information is that that you're receiving.
Right, yeah. Right. And so it's a good screening tool. It's something to be aware of. You know, it's not the gold standard by any stretch.
How about you, Nick? Is this something that you folks are involved with?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, the emergency management community has really embraced social media because it's a good way to reach out to people with preparedness information, getting them information about what has happened after a disaster, to kind of do that rumor control, to be able to publicize exactly what information is available at that time, and also to find out, like, a damage assessment. You can find out what roads are open, what roads are closed, and where the damage area really is the best way is through the media itself and finding our social media, that is, and then also making sure that you're contacting the people who are on your team as well. There's a community emergency response team program that a lot of the emergency management agencies do here across St. Louis area, and they're using social media to use it a way to contact their people to let them know what's going on in their events as well.
If you could wave that proverbial magic wand, Nick, what would you do? What else is needed here, do you think, that would really, really make us more secure?
The real vulnerability right now is people with functional needs. We've done a really good job in talking to the general population about how to be prepared. But to get preparedness measures to those functional needs, people who are at home on some kind of healthcare system, people who are maybe in a wheelchair, people who have language problems and language difficulties, foreign languages and such, those are the areas that we're really keen towards now to be able to get them that preparedness message as well and how it's unique to their specific needs. Mm.
Alex, how about you? I mean, everybody wants that magic wand.
Sure. Well, you can't be you're never 100% prepared. So let's first take that off the table. I agree with what was mentioned before, the special needs population. So most of the policy that was written previously was really for that sort of middle 50% of able-bodied people that could pretty much take care of themselves in a disaster. So making sure that you made contingency plans for those special populations. You know, we even had a big problem with people that would not go to shelters because they couldn't take their pets with them. And so you have to come up with some sort of planning and policy to allow shelters to have pets in within the shelter. And so, but those are things, you know, you don't think about until you're faced with a crisis. But other sorts of things, I mean, the biggest sort of, I think the biggest issue really goes into training and education, more so than just the hardware. We've spent a lot of money on hardware, on radios and gadgets and things like that. But when it comes right down to it, you have to have the right training and education to know how to respond and how to do the right things.
You're talking about training now on the local level, or you're talking about on the national level?
Both. Yeah. And so, but really, it has to come down to the local level. As I said before, you know, the rubber hits the road at the the local level. That's really the people that in those first hours to days of after a disaster happens, those are the people that are going to be on the front lines taking care of the people.
Nick, this is a regional operation. STARS is a regional operation. How do you work with various jurisdictions? How do you bring them together to do training, to do the kind of consulting and the kind of dialogue that you have to make it all work?
The key is that they have to see the vision first, and the vision is brought to them through education. And things that have happened around the country as examples, disasters have occurred somewhere else that shows the need to be able to work together to become a part of a whole regional response system. Once you've got that vision, then having them sit down and discuss the possibilities of things occurring is the next step, and then what do we need to build those capabilities? That was the early part of STARS back from 2003 to about 2005. That was us putting together those different committees of the subject matter experts, the true champions of what we're doing out there, people from not only the law enforcement and fire, but from the region's hospitals and the public health agencies, as well as the volunteer organizations that all would be part of a team when a major incident occurs. Mm-hmm. It really starts off like this. Imagine a major disaster. Who's coming here to fix this? Well, you could fill a flip chart of different agencies and names of individuals that are known here in the St. Louis area that would respond. And then our question is, if they're all going to be coming here after the disaster to fix the problem, why aren't they now sitting down today to work this plan out so that we all know how we're going to respond when it does occur?
One of the things that occurs to me is having people come in, they've got to be able to get here. And we've got access to this area by bridges for the most part. Are there plans in place for alternate means of getting into this area if that needed to be done?
There are different routes that have been identified, but again, it's going to depend upon the incident which of those routes are going to be available. You're right, we have a lot of bridges here, but we don't anticipate that every single bridge will be down like after an earthquake. Some will have some damage. Some may still be passable. Some we may have to do retrofit to make them available to be used. But we have a pretty good idea. But if like today, someone say, well, what are those routes? Well, I'd be hesitant to say what they are because we don't know if they'll be there after the incident or if they'll even be open and available or blocked by debris and such.
Alex, how many people are working on this sort of thing in Washington? Do you have any idea?
I don't have an exact count, but there is quite a few people. I mean, if you just take the entirety of FEMA, I mean, there's quite a few people working on disaster and emergency preparedness, and then you add the security people and the health and human services people. So it's quite a formidable group of folks that work on this. But I think this brings us around to what we were trying to articulate earlier, which is when the president directs or when the national security staff through the president directs that we should be looking at these problems and developing plans, we really embrace what's called a whole-of-government approach. And I think that's really what we're trying to say here is it takes everybody to participate in the planning and the education and the training to make this system work. Eisenhower had this famous quote where he said, plans are useless and planning is everything. And what he meant by that is as soon as you write the plan and put it on the shelf, it's outdated. But really where the value comes in is everybody sitting around the table and talking about these things.
You know, I have a sense, and perhaps you do too, that a lot of people have lost a certain degree of confidence in government, particularly the bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And the notion that a lot of people are getting together and trying to work something out just creates this image of a massive ball of red tape and everybody's talking about it, but no one on this side of it is really quite sure that it's being handled properly.
Sure. Well, Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, had this famous quote that said, a camel is a racehorse built by committee, and right. He's not entirely wrong. And so I think the best, the best confidence builder that I could give you is that the people that work at this at the federal level take this job very, very seriously. And they most of them come from the state and locals, and so they understand a lot of the challenges that come with it. And if there's anything that the people that work on these problems realize is that, a lot hinges on some of the work that they do. And so they take the task very seriously and try and remove as much bureaucracy. Now, part of the bureaucracy is just inherent in the system. But the people that work on these issues really take it to heart that they're doing something to protect the country.
Nick, is bureaucracy an issue with you?
Oh, sure. We're better. Our middle name is bureaucracy, but I always like to say that that's in the planning mode. When the operations kicks in, when an incident does occur, those subject matter experts, the champions that we've worked with over the last 10 years, are going to do the job, and they're going to get it done. They're going to take care of it, whether it's bureaucracy there or not. They'll make sure that the fires will be put out, people will be rescued, and those who are injured will be transported in the hospital in a timely manner.
Alex, you are billed as an expert on weapons of mass destruction. What concerns do you have in this particular area? What is your biggest fear when it comes to the potential of WMD?
Sure. So we've already spoken about pandemic. So right. I think that's for, you know, that does
that's
rise to the
one.
Top of your list. You know, I would think so. And the reason for that is just because it says you know, there's no discrete event. It's such a widespread event, and you know, we hear news every day about H7N9 in China. And the coronavirus in the Middle East, and it's really I mean, all it takes is a slight mutation to become more transmissible to make this a really big problem. And we saw how big of a problem H1N1 was a couple of years ago, and how SARS was back in 2003. And so it can become a very formidable event. Now, with that being said, I think what really is not concerning, but something that we need to keep an eye on is this age of biotechnology that's coming about. And so, you know, right now we can do genetic manipulation as a high school experiment, where a decade ago it was Nobel Prize work. And so you have to be reminded that, you know, science doesn't sit still for anybody. What used to take this whole room here of computing power, you can now put in your BlackBerry. And that's where we are getting with biotechnology as well.
Right. And with you, Nick?
The biggest concern is, it just used the scenario of the Boston Marathon bombings. That's the ones that really concerns us, because in order to stop something like that, you would have to totally lock down society and make it so secure that people can't enjoy themselves at our various sporting events. But because of that, we still have to be aware of what could the potential be. To put it in this perspective, the 9/11 attacks, as bad as they were on the country, were done with box cutters, not with any kind of sophisticated chemical or sophisticated biological agent. They did it with box cutters and using everything that was available to them that day. Every federal law, every local law was followed that day, yet they were still able to carry it out. That's where we need to be more aware of where our vulnerabilities are today.
We have a call here I'd like to take as time allows. Dominic is joining us. I believe, Dominic, are you there?
I am, sir.
Go ahead very quickly, please, if you would.
Yeah, hi. I'm the deputy commander for the 7th CST, the Weapons of Mass Destruction Team for the state of Missouri. And a lot of those things that you've been saying are 100% accurate, but wanted to get the word out there that every state has an organization just like mine of 22 soldiers and airmen that are at the governor's behest that go to support the incident commander. So all those wonderful things you're talking about with genetics and everything else, we help identify those. And there's a tremendous resource that we work with on that incident command structure and system. And everybody should be able to sleep a little bit better knowing that every single state in the union, and some states have two, where there are these teams of dedicated guardsmen and airmen that are 24/7 and show up with tremendous sophistication and assets to identify the problem.
Dominic, thanks so much for the call. And Nick, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, we're very much aware of the 7th CST, and maybe Dr. Garza is getting to speak to more of the technical capabilities.
Right. No, they're an outstanding asset. Absolutely. And so, you know, the CSTs really bring a lot of sophistication and expertise to the fight, primarily housed in the National Guard, but there's also a lot of other federal assets that would fall in along with them. But absolutely, they are an asset to these types of scenarios.
We've drilled them here in the St. Louis area at the Bush Stadium when they first opened it up, and we simulated a chemical attack there, and the 7th CST was part of the local response to that particular scenario.
We only have a little less than a minute left. Alex, how quickly can everything be geared up? If there's a need to bring in this team, deal with the hospitals, deal with whomever, how quickly can it all be gotten done?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, you know, if there were an incident to occur today, that it would get ramped up fairly quickly. You know, the federal government as an entity is pretty good about cutting through red tape when it needs to. I'm pretty comfortable in saying that, you know, if something were to happen, we could get ramped up in a short amount of time.
Nick, in 15 seconds.
I totally agree. And again, using the Boston Marathon bombings, you saw how quickly that community was able to respond to that threat. and actually identified the suspects pretty relatively quickly. The same thing would occur here in the St. Louis area.
And technology played a big role in that one,
didn't it? It sure did, yes.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Alexander Garza, again, welcome home.
Thank you.
And welcome back to St. Louis, and we look forward to talking to you again. Nick Ragnani, thanks for being with us. Good to talk to you again.
Good seeing you.
Continued good work for both of you. Thanks. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the opportunities and challenges of researching and treating rare diseases, conditions, and disorders. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.